Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the first weekend of September 2025. We are into the fall season, although the weather over the past couple of weeks kind of gave us a late summer, especially contrasted with that very delayed onset of warm weather back in April and May and early June with all that cool weather to have. What essentially ended up being the second longest streak of days with temperatures reaching 60, the longest ever streak of days reaching 65 and tying for second longest streak at 4 days of in a row of hitting 70 degrees. A remarkable stretch of warm weather here in late August and into early September. Forecast calling for rain in the coming days, though. Sounds like we're going to head more properly into fall. If you're getting out there, I'd love to hear what you're seeing. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can hop up on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a comment there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded this past week. It is mushroom season, or mushroom season's all year in some respects, but yeah, it seems like this is the peak mushroom season. I often like to talk with Kitty Labounty during this time, as she is a mushroom aficionado, and this week, she was excited to talk about an advanced copy she has of a book, Mushrooms of Alaska, which is due out from the publisher, due out at your favorite bookseller in mid-October. So something to look forward to. But we'll go ahead and join the conversation with Kitty talking about that book now.
I'm very excited to have an advanced copy of Mushrooms of Alaska by Noah Siegel, Kate Mohat, and Steve Trudell. It's not quite out available to the public, but it will be, I think it's October 16th that it will be available. They really pushed and pushed to get it ready by, you know, the end of August, September, but publishing houses have, you know, things take a while, so... Kate sent me an advanced copy to review and look at and just enjoy, actually. I'm not going to give her any useless comments at this point. But it's a great book. I really enjoy it. It has a couple of features that are a little different. It has the usual features, and I'll get to those. But one of the things I thought was actually kind of cool, when I went to the Girdwood Fungus Festival last year, kind of got a prelude of what was going to be in here. There's a really nice discussion of a couple of pioneering mycologists in Alaska. Two women, actually, Virginia Wells and Phyllis Kempton. You know, they hardly ever in mushroom guides put, you know, kind of history a little bit of the area. But it was a pretty cool thing that they did. These two women came to Anchorage sometime in the 50s separately. I think they were part of a garden club. And then they decided to have fungus study group because there was no information available on Alaska mushrooms. And they were pretty serious about it. You might call them amateurs, but they published a lot of scientific papers, and they worked with Dr. Alexander Smith at the University of Michigan, who actually helped fund a lot of their travels around Alaska so that they could collect, you know, a broader area than they could just quick drive to around the Anchorage area. So it was kind of cool that they did a little homage to these two ladies.
And from the 50s is when they were?
50s and 60s, actually. I think Phyllis Kempton actually worked later. She actually worked with Dominique Collette, who unfortunately passed away fairly recently. He worked on willows and insect books. I think people might be familiar with those. And I know that Kempton was working with him on another mushroom book. But I think they published the first for the Cooperative Extension, a little booklet on Alaska mushrooms, and all the illustrations were watercolors that they had done.
Oh, I might have seen that.
Yeah, it's probably still out there. You know, there's probably not a lot of copies.
Yeah,
I might have
that on my shelf. I'd have to look because it was. I do remember an old, not very thick, just but it was a watercolor book, kind mm-hmm. of older book of mushrooms of Alaska.
And you know, there's been one since then that also used watercolor, so it could be that one you're thinking of. But at any rate, it's out there, and it could be one of those things that they have at the library here, in the Alaska collection. And then, you know, there's a section. It's actually this whole section called starters, you know, that talks about what are mushrooms, you know, gives the whole introduction to what an actual a mushroom is and some ecology, what mushrooms aren't, you know, because they also talk about lichens a little bit. Just, you know, they talk about traditional uses of fungi in Alaska. There's not a ton. There isn't a ton of use that's known, but They did include that, which I thought was nice.
Both food and kind of material, like dyes and that kind of thing.
I guess
when in dyes, it's probably traditionally it would probably be more lichens than the than
yeah,
the
it's more yeah. lichens that they traded.
Yeah,
for the Letharia, especially that, you know, kind of crazy neon colored lichen. So then they go into habitats. I mean, it's a very, very thorough introduction. What sorts of trees and shrubs actually form mycorrhizae with mushroom-forming, you know, fungi, as opposed to ones that don't. So, like, our yellow cedar and the red cedars don't have a relationship with fungi that form mushroom fruiting bodies. So you can look around under those trees. And you will find some fungi, but you'll find more under spruce and hemlock. So, yeah, it's because it's the whole state. They talk about the different ecoregions and what you might find. Talk about collecting mushrooms. Sorry, I'm waxing on here.
Well, we kind of just jumped into the deep end with the book here. And I guess context-wise, it is fall, so it is...
Yes.
It's not the only time of year that you can find mushrooms. Certainly, as I've started... being aware that there's a possibility to get IDs via DNA sequencing of mushrooms relatively inexpensively. I've paid more attention throughout the year and just been picking things up. But certainly this time of year, this late summer, fall season, is when the most diversity and abundance seems to show up.
Yeah, especially for us.
Yeah, in Southeast Alaska. So this book, Alaska, Mushrooms of Alaska, you've worked with Noah, Kate, and Steve in various capacities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess not like professionally necessarily, but at fungus fairs or on forays and things like that.
The NAMA conferences, things like that.
And each of them have actually been to Sitka, given mm-hmm. talks as part of the Natural History Seminar Series over the years. In some cases, maybe a couple of different talks. I can't remember. Maybe Noah's here twice. And
Maybe Steve.
And Steve was, I can't remember if he was here once or twice. But in any case, they've all been through Sitka. And it's an interesting thing. Alaska... range-wise, covers like almost the entire lower 48. Of course, it's in the Arctic, so that makes it less diverse than mm-hmm. you would, or much of it is. But even so, it's an incredible around, you know, basically from Asia on the Aleutians to, you know, Southeast Alaska, and then from this very temperate part of the state in Southeast Alaska to the boreal to the Arctic. So it's a remarkable stretch of ecosystems to try and cover in a single book. It seems like, but they're, I imagine, breaking it down in part, at least in their introduction, talking about the different areas and habitats and how that shifts, you know, what you may expect to find.
Yeah, although it's kind of interesting. One of the pictures in here is of a king bolete, which is fruiting in a bunch of dryas.
Oh.
So, there.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah,
I mean... it's definitely an alpine Arctic habitat.
Yeah.
And then when I was up in the Arctic, when I was at Utqiagvik, there were a lot of mushrooms around.
Yeah. Oh, I just imagine they're different species for the most part, but maybe not.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't... There were a lot of quartanarias, and I did not investigate the species.
Well, I guess that's part of what's interesting. I mean, we've talked about this before with, like, respect to mosses. There are a few mosses, like Hylocomium, stair-step moss, Hylocomium splendens, that... you know, you can find throughout almost the entire state. And so, you know, maybe that's true of mushrooms as well. And there seems like there are definitely some that are in one region and not so much another. Even just locally, it seems like, you know, you can find some in some places and not in other places.
Mm-hmm.
For reasons that are not entirely clear to me, at least. But
I think Amanita muscaria is one you can find.
Oh,
or, you know, whatever name it needs to have. But people recognize that name. The fly agaric is pretty much statewide.
Yeah, oh, so that's another one of the sort of broadly ranged ones. So is this a book then, you know, as we're talking about it, like, is it good for folks that are just getting started, or is it?
Well, I think so, but that's me. So it's not as big as Mushrooms of the Redwood Coast, which is another one people might be really familiar with. And it still is one I probably wouldn't take out in the field with me. I'd probably leave it at home and then consult it when I got back. But it has a lot of information, and it's organized in a way that I think is user-friendly for beginners. So the end part of the starters section is actually a little bit on some edible and poisonous mushrooms. It's not the only place those mushrooms appear, but they show them to you right away.
Yeah, it's which seems important. Like if you're just getting started, and many people's entry into fungus,
like, avoid these things.
What can I eat and what should I avoid?
Yeah. Right. And so that's a really, I thought that was a nice feature. You know, and we have most of them around here, except for, of course, the morels.
Yeah. Every once in a while, somebody finds a morel.
Every once in a while, but it's not like, it's like, okay.
In fact, I just saw somebody walking down the trail. I was going up Indian River a week or two ago, and somebody like had this big, sort of bigger, like platter-sized chunk of chicken of the woods. And they're like, as they recognize me, and like, I can eat this, right? And I was like, yeah.
Not the whole darn thing, though.
Just the outer part. The other part gets pretty tough. But
yeah.
And some people get that digestive stuff. So I said, try a little bit of it.
A lot of people can't eat. I mean, you basically can't digest the woodier part of it.
Oh, okay. So even if you're not, I remember hearing that some chicken of the woods bothers some people, no matter what they eat, but pretty much the woody part is...
No.
Why would you want to anyway, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. But yeah, it goes through all the basics, too. You know, how to make spore prints with really actually very nice line drawings on how to do it a couple of different ways. They have a how to use this book. And then they have this... There's a key. Nobody panic, you know, to major morphologic groups, you know, so... And they're pretty straightforward. The language isn't, you know, too scary. Although, in case the language is scary for you.
They have a nice glossary.
They have a nice glossary.
Is it illustrated also?
I think so.
Sometimes that's helpful. Depending on the nature of the...
I should have marked it. Some of it is, some of it isn't. No, that's mostly not. But I swear one of these, I was looking at it and I was like, oh, that's cool. It shows a clamp connection.
Well,
but at any rate.
So I mean, it is interesting, like the key here, the morphological aspects of it. And I know in the last, I guess, few decades at this point, 20, 30 years at least, is kind of this revolution in understanding of relationships within, well, all of life, but fungi in particular. And so it seems like there's an interesting, because we're going to mostly, most of us are going to mostly interact with mushrooms through morphology. Like we see them, things that we can do. We don't have access to sequencing. We're not, you know, it's getting cheaper if you want to send it away. But even so, most of us are just going to be like, oh, that's cool. And so being able to say something about it while also, you know, tracking the relationships, you know, different authors seem to treat that balance a little differently. And this book kind of, I imagine knowing them that they are interested in being as best as possible, kind of relating the taxonomy as it's currently understood.
However, they have it organized by light spored guild mushrooms, dark spored guild mushrooms. So it's a user-friendly organization. And then they move on from the gills. Sorry, I should have marked all my little pages in advance, but I didn't. You know, into the non-guild, you know, so they have things organized in a way that's actually pretty user-friendly, I think. The boletes are in here, of course. Next, yep, boletes have their own little section.
I imagine the boletes are maybe more diverse, where they have more, seems like they like to associate with deciduous, many of them deciduous trees. Is that like birches and aspens and stuff, or... I just remember seeing them on iNaturalist and like, I've never seen that one. But
they probably do. You know, yeah. I am not an expert on interior mushrooms.
Yeah.
So this book will be very useful for me.
Well, and I suppose that's one of the other things. You know, you're talking about using it just as a field guide or maybe not in the field guide. But there is a certain amount of enjoyment that folks get just, especially with some books, and this might be one of them, just like looking through it. You know, they're nice photos.
Steve
and Noah both do really nice job with photos. I imagine that most of the photos are theirs, maybe all of them.
I think Kate got one in here, though.
Did Kate get one in there? All right. And then so it's just like looking at the pictures, reading about them, and then this kind of especially if you're reading about things that might show up in your area, and then there's nothing quite like that recognition in the field of something that you'd read about before, and you're like, oh, that's the thing.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these I know we have around here. We don't have everything. And maybe they're in some areas in Southeast, but not
yeah, Haines
right
or Skagway, kind of. Yeah.
Or even Ketchikan, who knows. Noah also spent some time in Wrangell and Petersburg, and I think Ketchikan as well. So I think they really, when they were doing all the research for the book, they really did try to get some good coverage.
As you're thumbing through here, you just happen to be in the Russula section with gazillions and gazillions of pages of, I mean, and by that I mean like 15 pages of red-capped Russulas.
Yes,
various
with
shades
variation
of red
and, yeah. and purple.
So Russulas are one of our, I've been noticing a bunch of those out right now. Folks are listening to this when it airs. This is a good time of year to see Russulas out there.
And I think it'll get even better once it starts raining again.
We have been in a stretch of remarkably warm and dry weather. Actually, as an aside, weather trivia-wise, as we're recording this on the 1st of September, it should air, you know, next weekend, but by that time, we will probably have set the longest streak ever of days that reached a high of 65 by a long shot. I think today is tying the record. And then so the forecast for the remainder of the week is, I think Friday is the first day that's supposed to have a high as low as 65 there.
And a chance of rain, I saw.
And a chance of rain. So this has been a remarkable, especially for so late in the summer. I mean, it's been remarkable regardless, but then to consider it's late August and into early September, warm and dry. And when the rains do come, which, you know,
they will.
And maybe by the time you're listening to this, the fungi like to respond to that. And I guess that's one thing I was curious about is like around here, you know, it's so wet so often. I know in other places after the summer, the rains in the fall and then the mushrooms come up kind of thing. Like, are there patterns that you noticed or consider, like, what is it that's driving the fruiting of these?
You know, I haven't done a very systematic study. In my brain, when we have warmer, drier weather, it seems like we have more mushrooms. If it's just wet, I think we don't necessarily have the diversity. And I don't know if that's just because metabolic rate's a little bit higher and, you know, the upper layers of the soil or the trees are also pumping more. Who knows? But I haven't.
You're right. Yeah, fair enough.
I could be making that all up.
Well, it is. It does. I mean, I don't notice how much variation there is from year to year in timing. But it does seem like some species, I'm like, well, it seems kind of late for them. And then suddenly they show up. And so maybe it has to do with kind of the weather of that particular season.
Yeah, they also have a lot of Lactarius, which is another genus that we have a lot of. Very easy to recognize. You know, you break the gills just a little bit and you see some sort of, you know, milky juice or orange juice or in some cases yellow juice or juice that turns purple. I haven't seen that one in Sitka, but I think I did once.
There's one that is white then turns yellow.
Yes.
Like kind of a very pale yellow. But
yes.
Or, yeah, mushrooms that bruise, you break them and then they turn colors or, yeah.
Yes. There's all sorts of fun stuff. Anyway, I think I really do recommend this book. I have no idea how much it costs because it was sent to me. So it's a Timber Lake Press, and I am hoping that our local bookstore carries it when it becomes available.
So later this fall, so next month is from the sounds of it, they're expecting it to be available.
Yes.
I don't know if it may, if folks are interested in there may be opportunities for pre-ordering, that's all way beyond my ken, as they say. So I will defer to other folks' interest and maybe a follow-up library show conversation or something about the book.
Yeah. But, they changed the name of my favorite Hygrophorus common name. My thigh-high stocking has a new species name. But
well, that was your personal name, wasn't it? So you get to
thigh-high
use that anyway.
Thigh-high stocking, I can use that, whatever. They call it sheathed waxy cap. That is nowhere near as fun as thigh-high stocking. I'm sorry.
Well, that's the beauty of some common names. You get to
invent them. Anyway, I was thrilled. I've been waiting for this book, for a long time to actually have a really solid treatment of Alaska fungi.
It seems like there's been some things that were Alaska, but really south coastal or something, regional or south central or something.
And kind of limited in scope. Yeah. But I think this has a nice, I think from that folks, you'll enjoy it.
Folks with a lot of experience with both fungi and with books. Noah's co-authored a number of books. Steve has co-authored, this is at least his second, but I imagine there's more.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Kate's worked for, I don't know how long she's worked in out of South
in
Central.
Girdwood?
Yeah, in the Chugach.
I don't know exactly how long, but
a
reasonable amount of time.
Yeah.
She's she was the ecologist. Her position changed, but at any rate,
yeah.
She's still in charge of the Girdwood Fungus Festival, which is next weekend. You double checked for me.
Yeah, so as we're recording, it's next weekend, but as people are listening, it's probably this weekend.
Now.
Yes. Yeah. So Girdwood is one of, I guess it's the main one in Alaska.
Yeah, there's a little one in Fairbanks, which I think is trying to get bigger. And Cordova has one. Cordova is a little harder to get to than Girdwood, which kind of probably limits the numbers. But Girdwood's pretty easy. You fly to Anchorage and drive to Girdwood.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose, I mean, given all the sun that we've been having here, people's sort of like, oh, I got to get out and get some sun vibes may not be as strong. But if you're looking for an excuse to travel, often the lower 48 ones are a little later in the year, it mm-hmm. seems like. So you still have time to look into some of those. I know that there are scattered throughout the West and the Rockies, at least, probably even further east if you're
lots
into it.
Lots in Oregon and Washington. Last year, I got to go to the North American Mycological Association foray in Washington, which was a hoot. Incredible variety of fungi. It was
In one little, or was it because you could go a long ways, or
it didn't
was it
necessarily go a long ways? It was just there's a variety of trees, and that forest was really rich. It was actually pretty fun, to find all the different things and see everything out on the display tables.
Well, I guess it's good to be explicit about that. In part, is that many folks probably the first thing they think of when they think of fungi is, oh, they rot things. I mean, they're growing on dead stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the reality of many of the mushrooms that we're interested in is that they aren't rotters. They're
right. They're mycorrhizal.
So ectomycorrhizal primarily?
Usually, yes. Yeah. That's what's going to produce the bigger fruity bodies.
And so they have relationships with specific plants. Often some are generalists, but many are are essentially can hook up with a very limited set of plants. And so the diversity of plants really is a factor on the mm-hmm. diversity of fungi.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah. Very, very huge.
Yeah.
So travel around if you can, if you're into fungi to the point where you like to travel. Maybe you just like to look at different places and, you know, which is like super fun. You'll see a huge variety if you go down there. It was October.
Yeah.
It was late. Actually, it might have been. Yeah, it was just before Halloween, I think.
That was that late. So, yeah. If you're looking for, if you're planning to travel anyway, I guess, looking for something to motivate, that is something that some folks use as a reason to go a particular place. Not that we need a particular reason necessarily to go various places, but I know, speaking of travel, you had a chance to go visit. Have you been to Gustavus before for any length of time?
Not Gustavus, but I've been in the park quite a bit for work.
So Glacier Bay you'd been in, but not actually the Fortlands and Gustavus area
very,
proper.
Very little. I think once when the kids were little, we took the troller up there parked at the dock and, zoomed into someone loaned us a car, which was really nice because without a car, it's a really long walk to the park.
Zoomed into the park means something different these days than it did at the time.
Yes,
but,
we took the cute little trek to the park. And, Deirdre did her quick little junior ranger thing, and we looked around. And then, bought some groceries, and we had to get off the dock again because it wasn't a dock where you could just, hang out. It's a more of a pier, and the ferry usually ties up there.
So she got her junior ranger badge there. Did you have I imagine you had a picture of that.
I have it. I can't find it.
Oh.
I'm like so mad at myself. I'm like, here my daughter is a ranger at Glacier Bay. I have pictures of that kid in so many different national parks. But do I have that one? No.
Not that you could find. Yeah, it would have been fun to have her holding a picture of her junior ranger at Glacier Bay as a ranger at Glacier
Bay.
But
yes. I failed. My organizational system with my photos is it's getting better, but that's like I have ransacked my house for that picture.
Well, in any case, you had a reason to go visit other than the reasons you already had, but you had somebody to go visit as well. So you're able to spend a few days in Gustavus this summer.
5 days, I think, just right around 4th of July. Came home on the 5th. It was really nice actually just to spend some time in Gustavus, and I flew over there on seaplanes and rented a car, and it was perfectly adequate to the job of driving back and forth and looking around, and got to explore a little bit the Forelands, you know, that you can access car on the few little trails that we tried.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about, I mean, I've never been to Gustavus or Glacier Bay. And my impression is, I understand that there's this large Forelands area that Gustavus kind of, after the glaciers came, and it's even been growing because of uplift and those sorts of things. Mostly grassland or wetlands? I'm not even really sure what it's like there.
The part nearest... Okay, so let's start at the pier. We've heard about the pier where the ferry. There's a lovely little beach there, and there's a river. Oh, shoot. How could I forget the name of the river? It's like good something. Anyway, there's a little river there that actually, I remember one of my memories was that people would drive their boats up there and, you know, beach them on the tide. And then, you know, high tide, you take your boat out because there wasn't, you know, there's only so many places to tie up a boat. I still saw some of that for sure. So there's beach, there's these gorgeous herbaceous meadows. I mean, it was all the lupin was blooming and a lot of paintbrush, several other flowers, but those are the ones that really kind of dominated. Strawberries were already in fruit. They weren't ripe, but they were in fruit for sure. There's this big kind of beach meadow area, and then you gradually get more trees. So it's not just big wide open space. There's a lot of wide open spaces.
Oh, so there's a lot of forested in the forested land in the
town
as well.
Yeah. It was actually kind of interesting. We drove back on a couple of roads, and what was kind of cool was you could see just huge shore pines. I think I showed you a picture of one of them. Tall, straight shore pines, you know, that were as big as the hemlocks were.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's like, obviously, you know, our shore pine can grow like a lodgepole pine. It was actually pretty cool to see.
Yeah, nice.
But yeah, there were wetlands in the whole mix. I mean, there's roads that kind of go around, and we did our best to kind of look around. But there's a lot of private land, too, so you don't just go willy-nilly everywhere. We did find, there's one nice, Nature Conservancy actually has a nice trail in the Forelands that goes through some woods and some of the meadow area. It's called the Nagoonberry Trail. Not very long. It's like 3 miles. And that was actually a really cool way to see a variety of the vegetation that was there. But yeah, the lupins were just spectacular. And so were the variety of the paintbrushes. You know, they were red, they were kind of orange, they were yellow. It was nice. And they do have their own species of...
Yeah.
It's a
Chrymactis, Castilleja Chrymactis. I think it's endemic to just that kind of
that area.
Yakutat to Glacier Bay area, which is interesting.
Yeah, so that was kind of cool. And then just trying to figure out, you know, okay, what were the characteristics of that one? You know, and it was because it was, I thought it was a little fussy, but we got there eventually.
So did you end up feeling comfortable being able to distinguish them from, like, the red, the Castilleja?
The Miniata.
Miniata, the red one?
Not always.
Yeah.
Sometimes I felt confident, and other times I was like, are you fooling yourself?
I see, yeah. I mean, that's one of those where, like, one of the big experts, I guess, on paintbrushes is on iNaturalist.
Thank God.
He goes through and he identifies stuff, and in the past, he's been one of those that if you ask him about it, he seems willing to explain.
And I read through the keys and things, and I'm like, oh, yeah, this is fuzzy.
Yeah. So many species are. But that one of the reasons that you really wanted to go there was orchids.
Yes. Yes, and it's actually kind of a funny story. So I wanted to see the lady slipper, right? The Cypripedium, which is a big showy orchid. You know, I've seen species of that in the interior, but I hadn't seen any in Southeast. And so we went and looked at the iNaturalist observations, which, of course, were obscured, every last one of them. And but kind of you could see kind of what area they're in. So we, you know, tromped around quite a bit. And Deirdre had told one of her coworkers that I really wanted to see the Cypripedium. And, you know, they said, well, forget looking at iNaturalist. Go in the middle of the softball field. And I was like, what? So we went to the softball field. And, you know, I was looking around the edges of the softball field because I'm like, there's no way this big orchid's in the middle of the softball field. Come on. But it actually was in the middle of the softball field. It was past its prime, but I was still like, I saw it. I was very happy.
And it's maybe worth mentioning that when you say they're obscured on iNaturalist, that means you can... It'll put the date and year that it was observed and then a big box. Mm-hmm. And it won't actually show you the date or time. And the purpose of that is to protect sensitive species. So like orchids that, I mean, Gustavus is probably fine, but it's a general rule. People will go dig them up.
People dig up orchids way more than they should.
And orchids don't typically survive that.
No, and it kind of ticks me off. So yeah. Even people who know better do it. And it's like, just leave them alone. They're fine where they are.
And so, but they, I mean, and it's not just orchids. It's a general policy on iNaturalist that any species that's listed as threatened in any kind of list essentially gets obscured that way, which... you know, for them makes sense because they can't fine tune it so much. So it can be a little bit like if you want to go look at something, it can make it a little
kind
more
of entertaining.
Challenging.
And I tried to browbeat my daughter into asking one of the people who knew where they were.
Yeah.
But for some reason, she was shy about it, which kind of cracked me up. But we did find one, so that's all that mattered.
Well,
also a cool, what's it called? It might have been Coeloglossum, but it's probably not Coeloglossum anymore. The frog. It's like a frog orchid or something goofy. Also in the softball field.
Well, so the softball field, it's not like, I mean, we have a softball field here that don't always get a lot of use.
They play on that softball field every week, if not more than once a week. So people are obviously not stepping on these orchids on purpose. It's impressive.
Or they're just,
lucky. I mean, they're in a place you would have stepped on them.
Yeah, interesting. Like the middle of center field kind of thing?
Closer.
Oh, like, well, so
I
maybe,
mean, they,
yeah.
They, I mean, I guess someone, you know, like you're backing up to catch a ball sort of thing.
Yeah, well, interesting that they have served. I think they also grow elsewhere. I think there's
two
or three different species that have been found around Gustavus.
Yes, and there's some on some of the little islands. There's some on some of the points that were all further away than we were going to have time to get to. So I was, you know, prowling around. But the variety of vegetation is actually pretty fun.
Well, it's
so you find like really dry stuff like Schafardia, buffalo berry. Kinnikinnick was, you know, in abundant in places. And then when you got over to the Bartlett Cove, which is where the visitor center is, you know, it looks more familiar to us. It's, you know, there's huckleberries.
Is it that much of a difference in precipitation there, or is it?
It seems like it rains more at Bartlett Cove, but I couldn't swear to it.
I mean, in terms of those showy orchids, if I remember correctly, it's like there's some on Prince of Wales that have been found, and then Gustavus, and I can't remember if there's Haines Skagway area.
I think so, but I can't remember.
But they're really pretty sparse throughout the region.
Very spotty.
Not entirely sure why. It is possible that they've gone overlooked just because they're in a remote place that people aren't there at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
I found an orchid this summer. I'd previously seen it right along Mount Edgecombe Trail.
Right.
Platanthera ephemerantha. It's a relatively unusual orchid. It had been found along the trail before as well. And I thought, you know, because they brought in a bunch of gravel. So I was like, well, maybe it came in with gravel or associated with. But no, I was out with my son. He was looking for deer and I was just tagging along. And we were, as you do when you're looking for deer, not going out in the total open. We were kind of using the margins of the muskeg area. And, you know, places that you don't necessarily think of going generally just because you're like, oh, it's going to be brushy and who wants to go. And sure enough, there was I mean, two or three different plants in there that were blooming. I was like, oh, and if they weren't blooming,
you wouldn't see.
Yeah, you wouldn't even notice.
Yeah.
So it's the right time and right place, and so things can definitely go overlooked. But
so besides chasing plants, I took the day boat, which is a concession run, not for cheap. That basically spends the day up in the bay, which was actually a really nice trip.
Does it go all the way? Like, how far up does it go?
It goes up to, we were by Marjorie, I think, when we. That was about as far as we went, Marjorie Glacier.
I guess my
in the west arm.
My sense of, so there's two major arms of Glacier Bay, and the furthest up, is it up to like 60 miles that you can go up there? Is it that far?
We were close enough, we could see Canada. Right over the top of the John Hopkins Glacier.
But it's a long bay.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's definitely a long bay, and that's the area where on the Murrelet count thing that I did
some years ago.
Yeah. We were camped near there at Reed Glacier area, which is very close to Marjorie. So we spent like 10 days up there. Believe it or not, 10 days of sunshine, which seems outlandish. But that was made up for by my other big trip in Glacier Bay that was probably 10 days of rain. Packing and unpacking a tent every night. It was entertaining. So, and then I've gone on a couple other trips in the bay.
Yeah.
So it was nice to spend the day going back, and I got to listen to my kid give her spiel, and that's always fun.
Yeah. Well, so is it, I mean, you're far enough back up there, like, and then you have like the Fairweather range between there and the Gulf. So, I mean, do you start to see different climate, essentially?
It's interesting. Deirdre says as often as not when she goes on the day boat or on the cruise ships, and, you know, as a guide, they go, it's sunny.
Yeah.
Sunny and nice up there, even if it's raining at Bartlett.
I could imagine it's in a rain shadow or maybe even starting to be a little more continental on climate, like your Haines or your Skagway kind of thing.
The vegetation looks a little bit that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's such a young landscape overall, right?
Mm-hmm. That it's like, yeah.
I mean, even Gustavus isn't really that old.
No, it's not.
The Forelands, is it? When did those Forelands be exposed? Is it been a couple hundred years at this point, or
probably
not even that long?
Yeah, I can't remember the forest. There's a forest loop walk, a couple of walks near the visitor center, and those trees don't look very old to me at all. When I've walked on that in the past, they look maybe 60, 70 years old. Mm. I imagine it was certainly deglaciated before then. but yeah, it seems like a pretty young forest. But I don't know the years. I should have double checked.
Well, you know, we don't have to have all the trivias off the top of our head. But it is just interesting to reflect on how rapidly during the Little Ice Age it advanced there.
Mm-hmm.
And then how relatively rapidly it's retreated. Like in human scale, 60 miles, in Earth scale, 60 miles is pretty small. But in like human scales, that's an awful lot of ice to go and plug up. And it's like to however many hundreds or thousand feet deep in the bay proper was full of ice all the way up to the mountaintop kind of things. Or not, you know, literally the tops of the mountains, because Fairweather there is pretty tall. So,
right.
But a lot of that. And then, of course, and there are still tidewater glaciers, though, in the bay, several.
Yeah, I don't have a count.
Right. Well, I mean, but
yes,
you
there
saw,
are yeah, definitely you definitely yeah. saw tidewater glaciers.
Yeah.
Yeah, more in the west arm than the east arm.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I had a chance a few years ago. I was on a trip and we went into Tracy Arm, where there was on the mainland over south of Juneau, and there was that big landslide that happened recently that. You know, the satellite imagery and stuff showed the run up immediately opposite. It was, when we were in there, we went to the north arm of North Sawyer Glacier, and the landslide was by the main Sawyer Glacier, I guess. And it was too choked with ice when we were there to go in there. But we, you know, that was where they had originally were going to take us. But then to look at the satellite imagery and how And it seems like nobody was there when it happened, fortunately.
Well, there was a group of kayakers that were camping.
Yeah, they were further down the bay.
They still lost all their gear.
Right. So there was enough of a wave down the bay even to even do that. But if you'd been right by the glacier at the time,
it
would have had to been an awful big boat to, and even then, like even...
You'd have gotten tossed around pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what would have happened with one of those smaller cruise ships or something in there, let alone a sailboat.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty remarkable. So you think about just the active gel as the unloading of the ice and, you know, the fractures and the release on those rocks that allows rock slides to happen. And I know there was a really major one that is in the mountains, not into the water, but a few years ago where it was one of those that registers on seismographs. And they're like, there was a rock slide somewhere. And there was just this massive, massive slide, you know, mountainside gave way and then spilled for miles, I think, down the glacier. So it makes you just kind of think about, well, you know, when you go up Glacier Bay, it could be that one of those things is going to happen sometime. But
it's at least a bigger space.
Yeah. So it won't concentrate as much. Yeah.
But it would still be a mess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's for me anyway, it's kind of interesting to think about to be faced with, I guess, things on this scale that, again, by planetary standards is small, but by our little human, like, ability to deal with standards is massive, massive amount of power and force present in those places with the ice and the rock and all of that. But so it was sounds like an enjoyable trip.
It was. And I just realized that the lodge and the day boat and all that, they all close up Labor Day weekend. That's it. And, you know, the cruise ships are still coming in. There's certainly independent travelers, but because there's lots of lodges, but other things are closing down, like I think some of the whale watching trips out into Icy Strait. I imagine they're just like, well, we don't get enough traffic to, you know, keep running our business that late. So,
well, and as anybody who's lived here for any number of years knows, you can't count on the weather come September. And the later in September, the less. I mean, not that you can truly count on it even earlier. It can always be a little nasty. But yeah, days get short, weather gets rough. So it makes sense that you wouldn't necessarily want to encourage people. But if folks are inclined to visit Glacier Bay, then probably next, some year in the future.
Yes, I'd probably go in, you know, while things are, I think it, gosh, did the lodge open up when I was supposed to go there, which might have been in May? Anyway, I mean, you don't necessarily need the lodge, but if you want to go in the day boat, which I think is worthwhile, you know, it's a nice way to see the bay, you know, if you're not, because beating up the bay in your own little boat is a long trip, and you have to make sure you have your permit. So it could be really fun, but it takes some planning. So if you don't have your own boat, or you miss that little window for a permit, you know, the day boat's a nice option, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the ways that I sometimes look at it is that, well, you could arguably maybe do it cheaper in your own boat, except for that you have to have the boat, and that's way more expensive than a...
Yeah, I don't know if you could because of fuel.
Oh, yeah, that's that much, yeah.
I remember when we started going up the bay, it was Northwest, so we were like, we were discouraged fairly quickly because we were getting, you know, the gajibis knocked out of us. So, yes, we didn't go too far.
Well, and so the Rangers, or if you choose to go on like a cruise of some sort, that many of those have itinerary that goes up the bay. But each of those, so I guess this is the experience that your daughter's been having this summer of each of those cruise ships that goes in has a ranger or multiple rangers that go aboard for their time in the bay.
Right,
the
day
boat
programs.
And the day boat has a ranger on it.
Yep.
So they're interpreters that have been trained and studied, essentially.
Yes. Yeah, and they do kids programs. They do, you know, general commentary, and they do, you know, set kind of more formal programs too.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, I suppose it was interesting you said that you got to watch your kid do their little spiel. So, I mean, I imagine you've seen her do it at other parks at times.
Yes, I've seen it at a few other parks, but yeah, it's kind of fun. You know, she really enjoys working at parks and, you know, learning about all of them and kind of, you know, all of her stuff, I think most of her stuff has kind of a geologic focus, although she did do the deep dive for kids into insects and invertebrates. So.
Oh, for Glacier
Bay?
Yeah,
the kids programs, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that was fun.
Well, it is. I hadn't realized until, you know, until your daughter, I started, you know, sort of vicariously through you because of your daughter's decision to start doing park ranger and stuff, how much of an itinerant lifestyle it is for most. I mean, there are park rangers that settle in a place and stay there.
They actually get a permanent job. Yes.
Yeah. And so I don't know what the distinctions are, but it seems like most of the rangers, most of the places are seasonal.
Seasonals.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it sounds like it might be that way for a little while.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but
fair enough.
Yes, they're probably seasonals are, you know, they're valuable and they run the parks. Well, they don't run the parks,
yeah.
But you know, they're the ones that do a lot of the interaction with the visitors. So they are valuable
public facing.
Yes.
Well, and it seems like it's been that way for a long time. And I just, like, in my head, I wouldn't have necessarily assumed that, but for folks that like to travel or, you know, be different mm-hmm. places for an extended period of time, it seems like it's a nice, you know, career option essentially,
right,
to kind of do that for a while at
and
least.
There's all sorts of different ages of seasonal rangers.
Yeah.
You know, there's people that have retired from other jobs. There's, you know, people in there, you know, however, you know.
I've noticed that even at the mm-hmm. National Historical Park here, that, yeah, some of them are like, are you even out of college yet? Maybe not. I don't know. And others are clearly retired.
Right. And some of them are definitely not out of college
yet. And everybody in between kind of thing over the years.
So it's kind of a nice mix, I think.
Yeah. Well, I know that, I mean, before we have a little while left here, but you took a trip, maybe we could say down memory lane in a way.
Always.
Yeah. You like to go to Ashland. And
I get my Shakespeare hit every year.
Get your Shakespeare, which is Shakespeare. Yeah, I guess there's some touching on natural history in Shakespeare, but maybe that's better for library show. next tour on the library show. But I was interested, you know, one of the things that I found this summer and was surprised to find was a tule, which,
yes.
You know, maybe some of us who have, let's call it rural family background, I've heard of being out in the tules.
Yeah. That's an expression I grew up with.
And I didn't know that tules were, I mean, that was just like, to me, that was just out in the far woods somewhere. I didn't really know what that was supposed to mean. But it turns out, actually, that tules are a particular thing, T-U-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to see a bunch of them, as I understand it. Well,
I did see a bunch of them. It was a little hard to focus in and make sure that was actually them at, you know, 50 miles an hour, but...
Fair enough. They aren't considered to be native here. I don't know where these came from. But in Southern Oregon, the Klamath Valley in particular, but I think also Northern California.
Northern California by, Tule Lake.
Tule Lake, that they grow. There's these large, I don't even remember
they're
what.
They're tall. They're really
super tall.
They look kind of like reeds. Let's say they look like reeds. If you looked at it quick, you'd go, oh, that's a rush. You know, if you were used to identifying plants, but it's, you know, it has segregated into a different genus now. But at any rate, it has that kind of look to it. And they're tall plants. They're really tall plants.
The ones I saw were 6 feet tall. And I think they grow. Are they emergent in some places? I mean, the ones I saw weren't, but I think often they're
some
emergent.
Some of them, they're emergent. I think it varies, you know, depending on rainfall and where they're moving water around.
Right. In that area, especially where the mod is heavily managed. Yeah.
Yes. But it was, so we drove up from Ashland up the most windy, whimpery kind of road. My daughter's a great driver, so I'm not whining about her, but I was like, our rule with driving on roads like that is no screaming. And I held to the rule, but I whimpered a little. It was like one of those, it was beautiful. Oak forest, you know, it's kind of gorgeous country. And then as you get to the top, it breaks into conifers. And a nice variety of conifers. There are sugar pines and incense cedar and, you know, fir trees and stuff like that. And then as you continue over, you get more into these tule areas. Where the
dropping down into the basin.
Well, you're not dropping down very much, but yeah, you are.
So it's a high valley.
I think it's a higher valley, but
yeah.
I only grew up in Oregon. I don't know where anything is.
Well, I mean, that's a very different part of Oregon.
I grew up in, for sure. But it was just gorgeous. There were so many birds. Oh, my Lord. There were pelicans, and we saw sandhill cranes and egrets and great blue herons. And I swear I saw like an ibis. But, you know, again, we're moving. But all the blackbirds were really fun. And I saw one tricolored blackbird, which was a big treat for me. So yeah, lots of birds in these tules. And but the goal of this wasn't, you know, driving and looking at birds at 50 miles an hour. It was getting down to the Lava Beds National Monument, which isn't actually, well, it's not close, but it's not super far. But it's a huge shield volcano with all these lava tubes that you can hike into. So we, with all the driving, we only managed to do one, but it was still pretty cool to look at.
And did you get into the redwoods down there also?
That was another day trip.
Oh, you
the
did
other direction.
Multiple, I see.
Yeah, no, these would not connect very easily. So yeah, the Lava Beds is near Tule Lake, and then you drive back past Klamath Falls, back down into Ashland, and the other way to go down to the redwoods, you drive to Grants Pass. Then wiggle around to get into California, go down the, I think it's the Illinois River, and then the Smith River, and then get to the, at least as far as the Jedediah Smith redwoods. So big. It was so much fun. We used to go camping there all the time when I was a kid. Oh. So yes, I was, that was definitely memory lane. But just, you know, it's like the trees are so immense. It's just...
Had you been there since you were a kid?
Not since I was a teenager.
Oh, okay. I mean, it's funny because, yeah, sometimes when you're in a place when you're little and a kid, like, it doesn't seem as big anymore. But I imagine that this redwoods is, like, they're so big.
They're still
big
pretty
that,
darn big.
That they wouldn't feel any smaller than when
no,
you were little.
No, it was one of those things. It was actually kind of fun, you know, you just park the car and lean the seat all the way back and look out the window. It was like, whoa.
Is it that area where the tallest trees are? I know the redwoods are the coastal redwoods are the tallest trees that. But I wasn't sure. I mean, they grow in different places in California.
There's a long strip, and the bigger ones might be on the more the southern end of the strip. But again, we these were immense drives.
Yeah.
On wiggly, windy roads.
And these are remarkably tall trees, regardless.
Even if I don't know how tall they were. They're
strictly
darn big.
Much taller than we are used to seeing here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the girth is the other thing that you're just like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. And the only thing that really frustrated me about that was I kept seeing this bright red flower on the cliffs of the Smith River Canyon. And there was no pullout. There's no nothing. And so there was no way to tell what it was.
Yeah.
I was like, what are you? What are you? Are you a penstemon? Are you what? I don't know. But it was just like screaming red. But yes, it's a mystery.
Yeah.
And it's like there. Oh, we did also get to see some cool carnivorous plants on that trip. A Darlingtonia californica, which grows in both, what is it? Cobra lily, which grows in both California and Oregon.
It seems like these trips, I mean, you know, you've spent, well, basically your entire adult life in Southeast Alaska and Sitka in particular. But, you know, formative years were these family camping trips to often national parks.
National parks, state parks, yep.
Told the stories over the years. And at this stage of your life, it seems like you like to revisit some of those. I don't know that you've gone to all of them that you grew up in, but
it
just
would be impossible.
Yeah, fair enough. And, you know, I guess I imagine that it must have informed sort of how you, the things that you were interested in and
I've been interested in plants since I was a little kid, but yeah, I'm sure spending all the time looking at flowers in the Rocky Mountains and wherever else we were, certainly kind of set me on my path for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you, in the past when we've talked and, you know, you mentioned some of your travels, you like to give a plug for our national park system, places to visit. Some of them are getting pretty busy these days, but, you know.
But they seem like they're managing, you know, with timed entry and things like that.
Well, and then there are often little corners of the park that aren't the well-known part.
Like we found.
Yeah. So there was Kolob Canyon is part of Zion National Park.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it wasn't like there was nobody there. But
no, but it wasn't bad at all.
Combat parking or anything like
that. No, which is, in fact, the main part of Zion can be, I think Deirdre saw some fighting in the park over parking lot.
Yeah.
Parking space, sorry. I was just like, really?
Well, and it's good that folks are interested.
They're
in
passionate.
Seeing,
they are passionate about places, their parks and the spaces. So,
but
yeah, I encourage people to look around. I mean, I'm kind of when I travel, I like, I'm kind of a botanical tourist and a whatever tourist, you know. I was also thrilled to see grasshoppers all over the place, but sadly many of them were smashed on the windshield, but it was still kind of like, oh, I haven't seen grasshoppers smashed on the windshield since I was in Alberta, which is kind of a gross thing. I'll have to show you the picture of my smashed grasshopper, which I thought was kind of beautiful. But at any rate, yeah, I like doing those things and then mixing it with, you know, my little dose of Shakespeare or concert or something.
Culture.
Yeah.
Nature and culture.
Yep. Those are my things.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, especially in the West, there's a lot of opportunities to dip into a little of both, or the nature's not far away from the places where culture is.
No, even right, you know, people always remember it's like right in town. Mm. You know, Lithia Park in Ashland, you know, you would just walk back off the lawns and down on the trails, and there's all sorts of different trees and insects and things that growing back there, and there's certainly an awful lot of deer.
Have they ever been deer there?
Have there ever been deer there?
No, urban deer.
Oh, they're definitely urban deer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they need to do something about the urban deer. They're driving people crazy.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. Well, it's been, I mean, we're kind of getting to the end of our time here. And I guess it's just as we're, you know, in my view, we're kind of into the fall season. Plants are dying back here for sure. It's been warm, more like summer warmth. But you're just thinking back to that April, May when nothing was growing, and even the first half of June, and people were talking about, well,
I'm
gardening. They planted plants that like literally didn't grow for 6 weeks. You know, all those challenges. And then on the back end, it's like it was this tale of two extremes in our summer here this year, the early part being exceptionally cool and
tomatoes
gloomy.
Are now very happy.
Yeah, I imagine in the sun and in the warmth. It seemed like it was kind of normalish for that June, July period, and then, you know, this last part of August and the beginning of September is remarkable for its sun and warmth and dryness. So yeah, quite a season. Any top moments from the summer for you? I imagine maybe from your travels or maybe from here.
I still think finding that orchid in the middle of the softball field was a great moment, because it was like so totally unexpected. Even though someone told us it was there, it was still like, what?
Just kind of incongruous, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. It just didn't quite fit my thing. And then just, yeah, seeing the redwoods again was super fun.
Yeah. Nice. Well,
yeah. Nothing so big as those trees. But I did want to mention one more
time.
Yeah,
we should. So we started off the show, you were talking about Mushrooms of Alaska by Noah Siegel.
Yes, and Kate Mohat and Steve Trudell. And it will be available to the general public in October.
So it's too late to get to the Girdwood Fungus Fair this year, even if you're listening to this live. But there are some fungus fairs elsewhere, and there's next year. It's an ongoing, you know, yearly event up there. I don't know that in Sitka, sometimes somebody does something for mushrooms. I haven't heard of anything this year other than get out and look. There's always that available to you.
Oh, yeah.
And iNaturalist is a great place to know, post pictures.
And before you eat it, know what it is.
That also is.
You are not so hungry that you have to eat stuff that you don't know what it is.
It's good to be certain and, get help from folks with more experience if at all possible. And when in doubt, I guess, compost
it.
Yeah, or leave it. So it's good to be sensible with things like mushrooms. But anything else you want to mention here before we wrap up?
Enjoy the sun.
Enjoy the sun. Well,
if it's still there next weekend.
We'll see. Yeah. See what the weather is. Hopefully you've had a chance to enjoy the sun that we've had here. But we'll look forward to coming back another time. Hopefully get a chance to visit, you know, maybe it seems like we usually visit a couple times a year.
Yes. But. Well, thanks for having me on, especially to get to talk about the book.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded this past week with Kitty LeBounty. I want to thank her for taking some time to visit with me and also for bringing in the Mushrooms of Alaska advanced copy that she has. It's a book due out on October 14th by Noah Siegel, Kate Mohat, and Steve Trudell. Sounds like it'll be a great addition to your library if you are interested in mushrooms in Alaska. As always, thanks for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show. I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can get on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave a comment there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.